In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Hello, I'm Ernie Suggs, race and culture reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and welcome to The Voices of King, a 13-part podcast from the AJC. Originally recorded in 2008 for a short documentary, we sat down with 13 people who were close to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in life and in death. This podcast was originally released in 2018 to mark the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death. Now, as we move into a new era, we are revisiting these important interviews to give you a glimpse inside the making of history. We were proud to document these conversations then, and we are proud to present them to you today.
He went on to defy those who sought to kill him. I'm not fearing any man.
I ran to the car. What happened? What happened? And when I turn around, then I can see.
All I was thinking about was, Lord, don't let him die. You know, don't let him die. Don't let him die.
Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
I don't go back there. I've been there, but I haven't been there. There's nothing there that I want to remember, really.
Why King? Why the Prince of Peace? That was going through my mind.
This man, this one man, he taught us how to live, and he taught us how to die.
This is The Voices of King, a podcast of 13 voices, 13 people who bore witness to the last days of the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as told to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm Ryan Horn.
Former Associated Press reporter Katherine Johnson covered Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement. She was one of the more prominent female reporters covering the movement. In this 2008 interview with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Johnson recalls the moment she became close with the Kings.
It had started back when there was a strike at Scripto, and I was sent to cover it. And it was a very cold winter night, and Scripto was a pen manufacturing close to downtown Atlanta. And while I was there, I looked around, and there was one TV group, but I was the only reporter there, and I followed around. And about 11 o'clock, King said, it's time to quit. So everybody left, and he told me, this is a bad neighborhood, a dangerous neighborhood, so let me walk you to your car. And he did. And when we got there, it was just a few blocks away. I offered to take him to his home because at that time he lived on Johnson Avenue. And I drove him home. It was about 11:15 then, or 30. And Coretta met us, and she invited me in for coffee. And when I went in, I went and phoned my story in on Scripto and on the march. Striking marches. And then we sat around the table, and that's the first time I ever heard King just explode into brilliance. It was fascinating to listen to. And he talked about his nonviolent movement and so forth. And I remember thinking then that you couldn't hear Dr. King without feeling an emotional reaction. And he really got to you, made you think of things you never thought about before. Anyway, we were there for a good while, and when I left, I thought then that the black movement had found a voice in this very passionate young man from Atlanta.
From that moment on, Johnson developed a bond with the King family unlike any other reporter. She was the only reporter allowed in the family's home from the moment reports surfaced that King was shot till the day of the funeral. Former AJC reporter Jim Ock Mooney conducted the interview with Johnson in 2008.
Katherine Johnson was an AP reporter in Atlanta in the early 60s, and she was one of the first women who covered a lot of the civil rights stuff, frankly, because a lot of the white Southern men in the AP bureaus in the South, some of them, of course, understood there was a story, but some of them weren't real eager to cover some of these things, and so Katherine got opportunities that she probably wouldn't have gotten otherwise to go and cover things like the desegregation at the University of Georgia, and the desegregation at the University of Alabama when Wallace stood there in the schoolhouse door and said segregation now and all that stuff. And so over the coming years, she maintained a relationship with King and Coretta, and covering them sometimes, but also with Coretta just sort of being her friend. And you can imagine how much somebody like Coretta, with all the stuff her husband was going through and all the stuff she was involved in, needed a friend, you know, needed to talk to people. And so it's kind of interesting that a reporter was able to forge this kind of relationship.
Well, I'm Katherine Johnson, and I worked for the Associated Press for many years, and I was during the 60s in particular. I started out in 59 on the news side, and I covered King, the civil rights movement, I suppose more than any woman in the country, because I never saw a woman in most of the demonstrations and so forth that we covered. And I got the movement because I was young and green and cheap labor. And the men, they were traditional Southern men with Southern views, and they didn't want it. And so that's why I got it. But then when King became famous, they did want it. But I had it sold up by then. And I was the only woman, and a only person, a reporter that is, in the King household from the time he was shot till he was buried.
Why was that? I mean, you already had a friendly relationship with the King family, correct?
Yes. Well, it had started back when there was a strike at Scripto, and I was sent to cover it, and it was a very cold winter night, and Scripto is a pen manufacturing close to downtown Atlanta. And while I was there, I looked around, and there was one TV group, but I was the only reporter there, and I followed around. And about 11 o'clock, King said, it's time to quit. So everybody left, and he told me, this is a bad neighborhood, a dangerous neighborhood, so let me walk you to your car. And he did. And when we got there, it was just a few blocks away. I offered to take him to his home, because at that time he lived on Johnson Avenue. And I drove him home. It was about 11:15 then, or 30, and Coretta met us, and she invited me in for coffee. And when I went in, I went and phoned my story in on Scripto and on the march, striking marches. And then we sat around the table, and that's the first time I ever heard King just explode into brilliance. It was fascinating to listen to, and he talked about his nonviolent movement and so forth. And I remember thinking then that you couldn't hear Dr. King without feeling an emotional reaction. And he really got to you, made you think of things you never thought about before. Anyway, we were there for a good while. And when I left, I thought then that the black movement had found a voice in this very passionate young man from Atlanta. And from then on, I was occasionally invited for dinner, usually when he wasn't there, but Coretta wanted to talk and so forth. And wasn't writing much about her then, because she really didn't sort of come in. But she enjoyed me, I guess, and I got to know her. And when she called for something, I would usually respond. You know, for example, she called me and said that I was an opera buff, and she knew it. And she wanted to go to, I've forgotten the name of the opera, but Leontine Price, who was the first black diva to sing in Atlanta. And in fact, the Metropolitan Opera had never had a black woman singing in Atlanta before. And that was at the Fox Theater, and that was one of the early theaters that was integrated. And so I gave them my tickets. I called the opera, and they said they had none. And so I told them who the couple was and warned them, because King was going to be in town that week. And they said, sorry, you know. So I gave her my two tickets. And they called the next day, she did, and said that the Leontine Price had invited them backstage and they had really enjoyed it, so forth. So it was that kind of an association, you know, and so that's how I really got in the house.
The night King was assassinated, mm-hmm. I know you were out on a date.
Right.
And y'all heard about it on the radio, I believe.
Yeah, we were.
I'm going to take you to the house. Mm-hmm. And y'all went, and you drove straight over to Sunset, where he was living in Vine City, near the AU Center. And there were already a good many people there. Tell me, pick it up from there. Tell me what happened when you went to the door.
Yeah, well, it was pouring down rain, for one thing, and I dashed into the rain to the porch. And I remember several reporters were there, including a New York Times guy. And there was an officer on the porch, a policeman, and he said, no reporters allowed in. And by that time, the door opened, and down the long hall, I could see Coretta, and she was in a pink, rose pink gown and robe. And she spotted me at the outside, and she told the officer, let Catherine in. And he did. And so that's how I got in the King household. And I was there for 5 days, the only reporter in, except an SCLC man at one time or two, but they never wrote anything, you know, that I saw and so forth. And she invited me, she gestured to me along with Yoki to go to her bedroom. She didn't feel like seeing people. And she craved violence. She craved privacy. And it was interesting. She'd had a surgery about 6 weeks earlier. And so she climbed in bed and rested against the pillows, and I sat in a chair nearby. And Yoki was lying on the floor. She had on pink pajamas and pink curlers in her hair. And it's a 12-year-old. And we were watching The King on television. And it was fascinating because that was the speech he made the night before in Memphis. And here was the night he was shot. And I, you know, it felt eerie to be in the house where he was, and his wife and his child. And he said, the only time I saw her weep some is when he said, I am not afraid, blessed is the name of the Lord. And we had a phone call. We were stopped at one point because Lyndon Johnson answered, and she said, yes, Mr. President. So I figured that's who it was. So I left the room briefly because I felt she deserved some privacy with him, and then went back in when she finished, and I didn't ask what he said, and know that she obviously called to offer condolences. And we sat in there and just listened to the television. That's really all we did.
And that was the only time she really registered
outward
emotion? Was
well, that she wept a little bit then, you know. I could, but she didn't. It was very quiet, silent, and I think she felt far more than I did that he was might get shot, because he told her earlier. He said that I was stopped in the airport to search the plane because they thought it was been told there was a bomb on board, and he said often that he expected death to come at any time, any place, and he had given her plastic flowers for something, and she told me about that, not that night, but another time, and she said, what did you give me plastic flowers for? He said, they're to remember me by. So it was that sort of thing. It was, I think she was, of course, devastated, but she also half expected it too. The death would come.
Right. You tell a story sometime in the days after that, when you were around the house, Coretta asked you to drive King's father, Daddy King, down to see, I think it was the Atlanta Braves practicing.
Yeah.
He was a great baseball fan. Tell me about that for a minute.
Well, she said nobody would be there, and the other children were gone, and Dexter was the only one that, then she didn't want to leave him. And she asked me if I'd take him along and drive Daddy to the airport. See, I was in the house all day long, early morning, and she had to come out and tell the Secret Service that you have to, it's okay to let her in. And and so I was able to stay in. And then we got to the, I tried to talk to Daddy King a little bit, but he was a delightful man. I was very fond of him. But I tried to talk about the Braves because I followed the Braves a bit myself, and he couldn't respond. You know, just muttered hello, and he was just very, very depressed and down. And I dropped him off at the Braves stadium, and I was headed to my house because I needed to get some fresh clothes. Oftentimes I stayed there at 11:30, and one night I stayed all night. I needed to run by my home, and I was going down Ponce de Leon, and Dexter started crying. He was 7 years old then, and a police car stopped next to me, and it was there were two policemen in it, and at that time I don't think there were any black policemen who were in the cars. I don't know. Anyway, they happened to be white, and they leaned over, and I saw them looking at us. I stopped for a red light, and there I was with a little black child. That was an unusual sight at 68, you know. And so I thought, uh-oh, if I get stopped and I explain I had the King child with me, before Dr. King's even buried, I'd get into trouble. So I drove into Midtown. I've got a friend who lived in there, and she wasn't home, but her mother was. And she hugged the child and gave him a glass of milk and some cookies, and we took him out in the backyard where there were a bunch of kittens. A cat had kittens, and he started playing with the kittens, and he was all right. I took him home. Mm-hmm. But
Tell me about the morning of the funeral when you came to the house and were there when Jackie Kennedy arrived.
Yeah. Well, I had gotten up before dawn to go by the AP office to write a story on what I could about Jackie Kennedy arriving. Of course, we didn't know if she'd arrive. We would never have used it until she did arrive. But she wrote and said, well, you know, Jacqueline Kennedy came to meet the widow and so forth. And you could sort of go along a short story on it. Because I'd already been in the house, I knew what the house was like and how many. There was always a little circle of women, mostly black women, and mourning clothes, and it was. I did that, and I told them don't publish this until I call and make sure she visits the house, and that was the understanding. And then I drove to the King house, and I got in okay without, they knew me pretty well, but I knew that they wouldn't let me stay unless I had Coretta had a vouch for me, and I thought it was not tasteful at all to have her say anything about, and have to come out of the bedroom just to say it's okay to have Catherine. So I put on an apron in order to cook breakfast for the King family. Now, Coretta never came out of the bedroom, but she'd gotten up early, too, to meet her parents from Alabama, Mr. and Mrs. Obadiah Scott. And they were very nice, though, very quiet. They had very little to say. But so I found a big apron, and I got them rattled around the pots and pans, and I scrambled some eggs and made some toast and bacon and coffee and milk, and I fed all four of the children plus the old folks. And by that time, of all people, meanwhile, the youngest, Bernice, had spilled orange juice on her skirt. So that wouldn't do either. It was a white dress. So I had to take off the dress and wash the skirt and out of orange juice and then iron it. That put me behind. I was really concerned. By that time, the doorbell rang. And so I rushed to the door of the dining room where you could see the front door. And I had on an apron and a towel over my arm. I hadn't had time to... Jackie Kennedy walks in, and the only other white person in the living room at that time was Ivan Allen, the mayor. And she spotted me, and she made a beeline to me, and she, to my amazement, she shook my hand. And the only explanation I have is, to this day, I feel she thought I was the King's white maid, which is the reason that she, you know, was being extremely polite on that. Something. And when she went to the bedroom with Coretta for about 5 minutes, and then she came out, and they came out to leave. And when they left, I picked up one of the many phones in the King home and dialed the office. And I said, hello, Mother, this is Catherine. And I just wanted to let you know that Jackie Kennedy was here. And this guy who answered, it hadn't been there when I put it in, and he didn't know about the arrangement. And he said, lady, you have the wrong number. It just set my heart into a fast beat, you know, because I know that they needed to get the story out. And I said, oh, no. I said, this is Catherine. And He said, "Oh, is this Catherine? Are you trying to tell me something?" Yes. Anyway, he finally got the message, so the story went out.
When we come back, Johnson shares her most memorable moment of King's funeral as a reporter closest to the family.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I'm Ernie Suggs.
And I'm Ned Ravone. Atlanta has been known as the Black Mecca for so many years, but that means something different to everybody.
It means everything to me. Every day I wake up, I learn something new.
Well, you all can learn something new by subscribing to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's new newsletter called Unapologetically ATL. It's all about the people, the events, and the entertainment happening in Metro Atlanta that Black people might want to know about.
So subscribe today at www.ajc.com/unapologeticallyATL.
Welcome back to the Voices of King.
I know you were you were in and out of the church during the funeral, and tell me about what your most vivid memory of the funeral and the procession afterwards is.
Inside the church, or the whole thing, you mean?
The whole thing. I think probably more outside and the procession.
Well, when I came out of the church, we were spelling each other then. They were AP people, and of course, when they would only let one of us in at a time, so after about, the service was very long. After a short time, half hour, 45 minutes, one would come out, and we had the whole procession to cover and so forth. And when I came out, I climbed on top of the King Hearse because it was there and I could see everybody. And they, nobody said a word. They were so mesmerized about watching people coming out. And of course, all the famous people, even Nixon was there. And the one towering figure of all was Wilt Chamberlain. And he was, I don't know how tall he is, but he was way above everybody. The thing that I think, there's several things that the most vivid in my memory, and one of them is that I had gone to the Ebenezer Church in February and heard the famous I'm a Drum Major for Peace speech. And I hadn't wanted to go because it was one of the rare weekends off. And I called my boss. He said, "We can't, our budget is blown," and because it was always blown with everything that was going on in the 60s. And I think he knew I would cover it because I felt very strongly about the movement. And I was afraid I would miss something important. So I went and I taped it, plus took notes, because you get so scared something would happen to the machine or whatever. And when I got back to the journal building, actually where the AP was, and I typed it up and sent it to AMs and PMs and on my own time and so forth. And which I'm glad I did now. I always did, but that day, listening to, as far as you could see down Auburn Avenue all the way to the city, there were loudspeakers, and you could hear I'm a Drum Major for Peace playing, And I remember being the odd feeling to realize that after all the extra work and hours that I'd done with such energy and passion, that what I'd done had made a difference, because the thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who were there, 150,000, they wouldn't even be hearing that unless I'd gone to the church. Now, SCLC and Ebenezer, they also tape all those and speeches, but they didn't have the ability to send it worldwide the way AP did. When I sent it, it went on the AWOL around the world, both for AM's papers and PM's papers. And that was one vivid memory. It was just very personal. And
you walked that whole route from Ebenezer to the AU Center. Describe that to me. What that procession that we've all seen pictures of with the mules and the mule-drawn wagon and all that, what was that like? What did it sound like? What did it look like? What do you remember from it?
Well, I remember that it was At first, when we got there, we'd been told to expect violence because cities all over the country were blowing up and burning. But it was very quickly obvious that there would be no violence because there were so many little children all dressed up for Sunday best. And the men were in jackets and so forth, and the women were dressed. Of course, there were many different types, but there were men in overalls and so forth. But it was quite obvious that the people of Atlanta, particularly mostly black, there were quite a few whites too, but they were there to mourn King, and to honor him, and there was. I never saw any violence. I know that they had problems about it. They were concerned about it, and a lot had been done. But the great crowds, I never saw any of it, except they would sing, and that was helpful a lot. And King was lying on it was a horse-drawn carriage, old Georgia mules that they had done to show his feeling for the poor. And he always led marches in the past, but here there were people in front of him and back of him and beside him. They were, you know, march. It was very, very moving and very touching to be part of that. And then when we got to, Spelman?
It was the quadrangle at Morehouse.
Yeah, Morehouse. That's right.
Or the Oval. I forget. But anyway, it was at Morehouse.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'd been to Spelman for when they first brought the body home. That's where they were. Anyway, that was interesting too. There was a talk and whatnot, and then we all apparently got a ride to the cemetery. But then I had to walk back. But I got pretty close to the everybody at the cemetery because I had so many, you know, press passes on me and special ones for that. It was so crowded, by the way, you're talking about. Crowded, police would say, you got to move outside of Ebenezer. And they would say, man, there's nowhere to go. And there really wasn't. He said, man, you got to move, you know, because I can't stand here and so forth. No, I don't think anybody expected the 100,000, 150,000 people. And at the cemetery, there was several funny things, I think.
Well, you tell me about, there was one thing that I thought was particularly touching about the Haile Selassie, the Ethiopia laying.
Well, actually, at the end of the ceremony, Coretta put a hand on the, before they lowered this head in the coffin there, and so did Daddy King. Daddy King wept, and she did too at the funeral then. And then it was all over. And people were leaving, but I was hanging around a little bit to watch. It was like watching a Fellini movie. People were trampling all over everything to get closer when the service ended, to look and see what they could see and so forth, picking up flowers. And there was a woman sitting in the flower bed with a typewriter. I didn't even recognize her, where she was from. But Haile Selassie was a very diminutive little figure and with a long gray cloak. But he's very regal looking, you know, very. And he walked over and picked up a rose from some of the flowers, and then walked over and put it at the on the king. And I thought it was very touching because very obviously a very private thing he did. It wasn't part of the ceremony and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I had walked back to the journal building, and I think it's about 4 miles.
Four or five miles.
I was already, you know, I'd walked away. And I'd worked hard all week with very little sleep, and I had to stop. In those days, there were no laptops, no cell phones. I begged somebody, he had his door locked, a business guy, and I said, I'm a press, and I've got a phone in, and he unlocked it and let me in. And I made a quick call. We had to check in, you know, all the time with the office. And when I got back, I went into that newsroom at that time. You could hear the machines going, the tap-tapping, and cigarette smoke, and shouting, and whatnot. So I just went to around the corner in the journal building. There was kind of a sitting room for the women, and I sat there, and that's when I really felt that he was really gone. You know, news people keep emotions to themselves. They have to keep it in check, or they couldn't cover it and be clear-headed about it. But then I didn't have to anymore, and I couldn't even get up for several hours. I just sat there. I was unable to get up. I was just just sort of wiped out, you know, before I could go home.
So it affected you too, and not just physically, but emotionally?
Well, I felt was that with all I've been covering him since 59, and off and on with demonstrations and so forth, and out of town, the Selma March, whatnot, and it really struck me then that King would not march no more, and never again would we hear the sound of his voice, which was, you know, it was a great orator. And I was really, that's when it hit me, sort of. You know, you have to, sort of. I've written everything I needed to write at that point, and the 5 days were over.
I know while you're covering, you have to be separated and emotionally distant to an extent so you can cover it objectively, but while you were covering it, I mean, what was the first thought that raced through your mind? I mean, were you, when you heard it on the radio on that day, were you, was it first thing work
felt,
or emotion?
What did I feel when I first heard it? And I was stunned, all right. I really felt, and in fact, my date and I, he and I were both almost totally silent. He didn't even ask me, do you want to go to the King House? He turned around and drove because he knew I didn't want to go. And we were silent, and we just sort of lost in the emotion of feeling, well, because I'd only heard that he had been shot first, but, you know, then it came late on that he was gone. And there's something interesting that we're not talking about me at this point. Charlie Kelly says he was up in Memphis, but he wasn't there when he was shot, but he was at the hospital, and they were crowded with news people wanting to see what was happening, how he was doing, and Andy Young came out with tears going down his face, and he couldn't talk, and he did like this to show that, you know, it was gone. And so we knew then that he had died. That's how they knew it. A couple of hundred press people, I gather. But I'm a little bit like Coretta. I mean, it was my mother, for example. She used to see me in demonstrations, and particularly after the scripto that morning, we were in the bedroom, in the den, and watching. I always had breakfast before the TV to see what the news was, and you could see it. I was the only white face in the crowd, with my notebook, you know, asking King all the usual strike questions. And she said, "Honey, be careful. I'm afraid someday somebody's going to kill that man." And, you know, that was years earlier. And in a case like that, you do think, you know, but at the same time, you are creamed with it. But as a reporter, you're so trained to observe and cover what you're covering, you do feel something. I mean, you get a sense of poignancy about what's going on, and you can write about it, but you can't let your emotions go. You can't. I've seen young reporters do that, and then they weren't any good afterwards. You know, they didn't get the story covered. While I wasn't terribly surprised, it was a shock still. And I knew that it changed everything on the movement, which it did. It was never, as far as I'm concerned, the civil rights movement that gave us, gave the blacks voting rights and ended segregation. It ended with King's death, more or less. I mean, that particular, those aspects of it. Abernathy was an aide of King's, and he was a really nice guy. He was great in the black church, but he didn't know how to really handle the press, and they lost interest and didn't bother, and he couldn't get anything else done. And that's my feeling, that particular movement really did what it needed to do, but it ended then.
You good? Yeah.
Okay.
Jim, you understand when you say you can't, you feel very, you have to go along and cover it?
Well, I mean.
But you do feel, you know.
Well, you feel, I mean, you know, it. You always, if you're covering it, you always feel a certain distance because you're focusing on the job you have to
do.
Yes,
absolutely.
And I mean, this is not a momentous thing, but I remember when I was there when the Braves won the World Series in the sixth game. I was in the press box that night. That year, I was covering the World Series for some reason, and I remember. And I'm a big baseball fan, and I'd seen the Braves so many times over the years. And when they won that game, I had to file something on Deadline, a color story about the scene there. But I looked at the watch and I said, okay, I'm going to allow myself 60 seconds to sync this up, just to enjoy it. And I stood there and I watched the crowd roaring and I looked around that stadium I've been in so many times and tears came to my eyes.
Yeah, sure.
And then after about a minute, I took a deep breath and said, okay, back to work.
I know.
And that's what you do.
Yeah, you do it.
You know, whether it's a happy thing or a sad thing, you have to.
That, when I went back to the restroom, I didn't cry, because I rarely ever cry, but I just felt devastated. It hit me really hard, you know. And it was shocking to hear that we wouldn't hear his voice again or anything like that.
Yeah.
In the next episode of The Voices of King, we will hear from Martin Luther King III, Dr. King's second oldest child. A special thanks to AJC reporters Rosalind Bentley and Ernie Suggs. Also to Senior Editor of Visuals, Sandra Brown, Senior Managing Editor Mark Wallagor, and our Editor-in-Chief, Kevin Raleigh. Be sure to visit www.ajc.com/MLK50 for the AJC's coverage of honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Ryan Horn, and you've been listening to The Voices of King.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song. A celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
The AJC's trusted veteran political voices, Greg Bluestein, Patricia Murphy, Tia Mitchell, and Bill Nigut, are the essential source for Georgia politics. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia. Sign up for the newsletter, download the podcast, subscribe to the AJC.